I love to get the chance to talking to people within the industry, and I'm talking, of course, about copper, about gold, about other, you know, other minerals, etc. Mark Brown is president of Pacific Opportunities Capital, and they kind of do it all. They're a one-stop shop in terms of they help raise capital, but they give the financial advice. Mark's background is has got the CA designation, and I know that from my own experience that a lot of people who sort of get in to various industries, in this case, we're going to be talking about, you know, mining, they need some of the business acumen too. And that's what Pacific Opportunities also provides. Mark, appreciate you finding time for us.
That's great to be here, Michael. Happy to offer some insights here.
Well, let's start with the one that, I mean, is hardly a surprise. People wondering about the impact of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, the sanctions. I mean, that's still evolving. Where that's going to go, is it going to be escalated? Is it going to find some sort of agreement to at least subside, you know, the hostility. So I just want to, what do you do when you look at a big geopolitical event like that?
So these are the black swan events that we totally look for. But having said that, I mean, just looking at the supply and demand for these metals, it takes a long time to build a mine right now. And all these metals are in demands for new technologies, you know, copper in particular, a third of the world doesn't have electricity and they want electricity. So the demand is very steady and very much growing. New technologies are increasing that. And then you come along, you know, so it takes a long time to build a mine, to find an economic deposit. And then you come along and you have this event like the invasion of the Ukraine. And that just throws a wrench into everything. And it's going to make these prices for these metals go up, because even if the war gets stopped, for a long time, these supply lines are going to be in trouble. I see Russia doing a lot of deals with China coming up, so that'll change things a little bit. I don't know exactly where that's going to go, but the rest of the world's going to be scrambling to get supply, and we've got a lot of work to do to keep those supply lines moving.
And one of the themes we've had on Money Talks for since really the summer of 2019, but into 2020, was, look, if we're going to do this transition thing, you know, to renewable energy, we are really short the essential metals. But your point there, so obviously we need copper, and I know you're involved with copper, but the point you're also making is this is not stuff you just switch on a light switch, you know, oh presto, I need more copper. These mines, especially in the kind of regulatory environment we are in the West, and maybe some people are a little nervous about the regulatory, you know, the government involvement in other jurisdictions, they take time. I mean, you can't just sort of snap your fingers. And so, as you say, it's sort of a guarantee of demand as we go forward, if indeed we are going to transition.
That's exactly right. I mean, just to give you an idea, even just finding an economic deposit can take 5 to 10 years. And then you need a lot of drilling to see the size of it and the grade and understand how you would process it. And even once you get there, the environmental rules, which are very well established in Canada and the U.S., and easy to follow, make things take longer because you do a lot of baseline testing for your environment to make sure that everything's maintained the way it should be. And these processes just take, they always have taken a lot of time. And remember that these resources, the mining companies, when you find a deposit, it's a finite resource. It's a deposit that has limits on its size, and it's going to be, you know, 15 to 20 years and it's mined out and gone. So you need to find new ones. And that's where these junior exploration companies really are the experts to do that.
You find it's an environment, just in saying that, that it may be better and more advantageous to actually buy one who's already in the business, who's already doing the exploration, probably has some proven reserves. It would seem to me that this would encourage sort of some merger acquisition kind of opportunities there instead of starting from just dead scratch.
Well, that's exactly right. And the major companies do some exploration, but a lot of it is left to these junior companies. And I really like getting involved. So we invest in the clients that we work with. We're usually a major shareholder of them. And I really like getting involved with companies that have some high-grade drill holes, high-grade drill results of whatever element it is they're looking for, or companies that are near historic mines, or maybe even that have a historic resource on the ground. Because that, once you get into that discovery mode and start to build that, and then maybe you get into a deposit and calculated or estimated resource, then that's where the big companies are going to start to pay attention and start to come calling and potentially buy out your junior resource company.
When you're, as you say, you get to choose who you work with. I mean, you could be hired also just strictly on a consulting basis, but when you put your company's money involved also to help finance, can you just give me like the two or three main criteria? Because obviously that's at a bigger scale than most of us invest at, but some of the same rules apply.
That's right. And we have a very specific rule. So I have two partners who are also CAs. I'm ex-Pricewaterhouse, they're ex-Deloitte's. And one of the key things for us is to work with really good people. We can change out the projects, we can change out the company or reset the company, but you got to have people that are well-driven and who know what they're doing, who've hopefully made discoveries before. After that, we look at projects and the elements and the jurisdictions. And because we're a smaller group and we get so many opportunities, we really focus on ones that we really like and think we can help add value to those companies by bringing them good financial oversight.
Tell me about the time frame, by the way. Again, I'm looking at individual investors being able to piggyback on what you've learned. What's a realistic time frame? Obviously, somebody comes knocking on your door and says, hey, I'll buy that whole project, I'll buy that company. That's a different deal. But, you know, just I just don't, you know, people impatient doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't. And I'll tell you one story. I mean, there was a company we started in 1999. That by 2012, after supporting that company for 13 years, was a $500 million market cap company. And through that whole process, we backed the people. We had to change out the CEO a couple of times, but we liked the project and we kept going with it. And eventually, that was a rare earth element company. And eventually, the share price skyrocketed and we were the largest shareholder. And then everyone came to us and said, how did you get so many shares? And I'm like, well, I've been buying this for 10 years and supporting it and backing it. And that's too long for most investors. But all the way along, they were achieving their milestones and the project was getting better and better. The grade was coming out good. And so that's the kind of thing we like to see is successful programs, one after another, that continue on. And eventually they get bigger and bigger until you get some major that comes along that really wants to take them out because they're the ones, they're the expert at putting those into production.
Sorry, I'm just going to throw a little curveball at you for a second because I'm going to ask you what you're thinking of the copper market and the silver market because you're involved directly, gold market, et cetera. But first, you know, I've been chronicling with Victor Adair, I mean, this incredible mess on the London Metals Exchange, you know, with obviously not being able to get an official price for almost 2 weeks for nickel, you know, the stop and start 1 week, not. What does that do to things? Or are you just thinking, okay, well, that's a short term deal. There's nothing really much for us here because we're longer term.
So nickel is used in lots of stuff that people don't know behind the scenes, but one of the popular ones right now is nickel metal hydride batteries. The hydride metal they talk about there is rare earth elements, but you need a lot of nickel in those batteries, and that's for electric cars, and that's an alternative to the lithium batteries as well. And I always believe you need a few different alternative technologies to work, but with the nickel market, you've got Norilsk, the Russian company that's one of the biggest suppliers. And they have mines all over the world, but their Russian supply is now basically stopping or they're not allowed to export. Or I don't know exactly what's going to happen there, but that is owned by Roman Abramovich, and he's been sanctioned. And so that's a big game changer for that market. And I think the nickel market will settle down a bit, but do I think it's going to go back to where the prices were? No, I think they're going to remain very high. And again, it's hard to find nickel deposits. We actually have one company drilling for nickel in Quebec. And that's early stage. If that company actually hits something, they have a good chance of hitting something. But if they do, it's, you know, you're 10 to 15 years before you can actually produce any nickel. And that's what people just don't understand how long it takes. And the grades of these deposits are also going lower and lower. And that's a problem because you're going to mine more and actually recover less. And so it's harder and harder to find these things, particularly with copper. So copper, people used to look at 1% as a grade for a deposit. And now you're looking at things 0.35, 0.33% copper. And those are big ones, those lower grade ones, but still that's a lot of technology to get that much copper out of a ton of rock.
And you're bringing another great point that I think is people aren't as aware of as they should be. And that is you do get different grades, you know, number one. And so it's not just sort of nickel, if you know what I mean. There's, you know, are you getting the right stuff, the right grades, that kind of thing. Let me go further with copper, because that's one of the things that was a big recommendation on Money Talks in February 2020. We were big on commodities. But, and again, it was sort of simplistic or straightforward on my part. It was, you know what, if you really want to do electric vehicles, and I believe the governments did and the public did, you really want to do renewable energy, we're not even in the ballpark for the amount of copper we need. And I appreciated what you were just saying. And it's not as easy to get, you know, at a high grade as it used to be. So what are you thinking of the copper market going forward? And again, I'm not asking next Tuesday, but, you know, 3-5 years out, the way you do an investment.
Well, The copper market is interesting because, as you probably have said before on your show, I'm sure they call copper Dr. Copper because it's a great proxy for the whole economy. And copper prices they've jumped up and they're steadily going higher. They're trading well. And you've got all sorts of problems on the supply. It's hard to find copper deposits worldwide. It's hard to get them in production. And quite often you get governments in regions where copper is heavily used, like Peru and Chile right now. Their governments are a bit of a mess. And people don't know what they're happening. So what that means is there's even less investment in those areas to find more copper deposits. So again, if you've got a copper market that's worth, it's much more than this, but say it was $1 billion and demand went down 1%, well, the price is going to go down a bunch. But what's happening now is the demand's going up 2, 3, 4, 5% with all these new technologies. And it takes what's already a very large market and it really pushes that price higher. So it's a big market. So steadily, I think it's going to continue to go up. That's going to lead to even more inflation in our whole economy because it affects so many things we do that people don't even realize. I mean, recently during COVID, copper is biostatic. Bacteria doesn't grow on copper. So people started putting copper back on doorknobs and stuff like that to help stop the spread of disease. It's just a property that it has. It's interesting. It's a very small use for it, but there's another use of copper while people were trying to avoid COVID. So there's lots of things, but I see nothing but good demand for copper coming up.
The other side that, I know I've kept you longer than I said, but the other side is both gold and silver. I'm kind of interested in personally, I'm looking at a monetary crisis. That's my thesis, declining value of fiat currencies. Your papers aren't buying as much. So how do you protect yourself? So I kind of have been talking about the gold and silver market. I'm patient with it. So let me start with silver. Just you can give me other. I mean, there's industrial uses, of course, that come into play here too.
Yeah, and silver is also used very quietly behind the scenes in lots of different technologies coming up. But what people don't know on the supply side is that silver is often produced as a byproduct from other mines. So there's very few primary silver mines. So it's hard to find a high-grade silver deposit. And when those mines run out of their primary ore, they're going to stop producing that silver as well. So it's got the potential in that market to actually explode. And that's why you get a lot of these crazy kind of silver bugs that say this is going to go crazy. And it does from time to time. It's happened in the past in the history, and it could easily happen again soon.
What about the gold side? That's, of course, people looking to protect themselves. I think it's a bit erroneous with inflation because we've got lots of incidences where inflation goes up and gold doesn't. But we have 100% when people lose confidence in the currency, gold responds. And of course, I know we're talking about real interest rates too and all of that, but give me your snapshot on gold.
Well, I'm a coin collector, Michael, and I'll tell you, people buying physical gold through coins, through auctions that I participate in Vancouver, often are paying way higher than what you see the quoted gold price. So the financial markets are one thing and all the paper contracts in the market are one thing, but the physical gold trade is at probably a 20 to 30% premium. And I think the price of gold that's quoted is going to catch up to that pretty soon.
And one last thing, because I know that, you're chairman of Alianza Minerals, Avarupa Minerals, it's in Europe. Geopolitical risk, I think that's on the front burner now. I mean, obviously you wouldn't want to be investing in Russia and, having been caught in that, I think people are having a second look at China or a third look. So it seems to me where your projects are, you're sort of at least eliminating a lot of that geopolitical risk, or at least what we anticipate at this moment.
That's exactly right. It's hard enough to find a deposit. So you don't want to find a deposit somewhere where you're never going to be able to mine it. You need to look in areas where there's good mining history, good mining expertise, and a good infrastructure for the environmental rules and a mining way of owning claims that is secure so that you don't lose out those to governments or whatever. So it's really important to be in good jurisdictions, and we really focus on that.
I was waiting to end with this question, and that's give me a grade for Canada. You just think broadly speaking, I want to do some exploration and develop and put a mine in whatever the substance, coming out of the mineral coming out of it. How would you grade Canada as in terms of, hey, that's a really attractive place to be, or, oh my gosh, they make it tough?
It's a bit of a mix, and it's a bit of a mix by province or territory. Some of the Northern Territories are quite good. They have very strict rules, but you can work within those rules when you know that they are. Quebec's very favorable because they still have a good attitude of mining there, and they actually help fund it a lot. British Columbia, you really need to know where you are specifically within the province. Some of the First Nations groups are fantastic to work with. Other ones aren't as advanced yet, and they're thinking about mining or whether they want mines in their areas. So you really have to know specifically. And of course, in our companies, we use consultants to help guide us. And we regularly meet with the communities, make sure that the groups we're working with are often actually working with us as partners on projects. So that's really important. So it's a very specific question. Canada itself is generally a very good place because we have so much expertise and financing expertise, but there's issues in specific areas you got to be careful of.
That was a very good answer, by the way. Mark, thank you for finding time for us. President of Pacific Opportunities Capital. He's also chairman of Alianza Minerals, Avirupa Minerals in Europe. But great to be able to pick your brain here and talk about the big and the small and get down to the details of what it's like on the ground. Mark, thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.